Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Everyone experiences the pain of loss of someone they care about at some point in their life. The older we get, the more familiar that loss becomes, but the grief that comes with it can manifest in many different ways, and how or if we seek support can make a big difference in how we move forward. I'm Lori Townsend, and today I'm filling in as Line One's host on a topic that I know a lot about personally. I've experienced the loss of close family members and friends who left far too soon. I know I'm not alone in that type of loss. Before I introduce our guests, here's a poem from an unknown author that was sent to me when I was 24, after my husband died and my sons were very small boys. I walked a mile with gladness, she chatted all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and not a word said she, but oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. This poem really helped me understand the weight and also the lessons that grief brings. I wish I knew who wrote it. 43 years later, it still resonates. Our guests today have a lot of experience in helping people understand and move through their grief, always with the aim of helping them find a path forward that brings them to a place of peace, acceptance, and a future that has joy, as we know our lost loved ones would want that for us. Dina Banez is a registered nurse at Providence Labor and Delivery. Dina is also the chair of the Providence Bereavement Council. We'll learn more about that soon. Rabbi Abram Goodstein is the rabbi for Congregation Beth Shalom in Anchorage. And on the line with us is Savilla Love. Savilla is a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist. Welcome, all of you.
Hey. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for being with us. And again, I'm filling in today. I'm not a doctor. I'm just a reporter. But I do know how powerful and life-changing grief can be, and helping others find the help they need to navigate it is important. So for all of you, let's start off with how you define grief. And do you all primarily counsel people who are going through personal loss of a loved one? Or do you also see people who are grieving over world events, war, climate change, strife in our country, causing political divisions within families? What is the sort of the overall arching themes that you see in folks that you work with? Who wants to start off?
I'm happy to start. One thing that I noticed is that people tend to grieve change, not just a loss of a loved one, but a big change in their life. And they go through the same experiences that I think someone who loses a loved one does. And we shouldn't diminish their feelings or their experience, even if it's not someone who's like a loved one, that they are in fact grieving. And often just naming it as grief for them can be super helpful for them understanding what they're going through. And that's another big part of it, is just naming it, naming how they're feeling. I found to be a very powerful tool in helping fellow folks manage and deal with their grief.
Savilla, let's hear from you.
Yeah, I would absolutely support what the rabbi just said, that every time a client comes in for one specific type of grief, it's always attached to other things, because we bring our whole selves to grief. So if they're very sensitive to things that are going on in the world, for example, if they're very involved politically or socially or what have you, and then they have also a significant loss in their life, that now that's their grief's compounded, and it's taking all of that into account, because a lot of people come in and they say, I just have this loss. And so, well, let's look at everything else that's going on in your life as well, because we bring ourselves to grief. So that's always going to affect how we grieve. And so when a rabbi talks about change, that's really the biggest struggle that we have. That's absolutely true, because when we have a loss of self, such as how we identified ourselves when this particular person was in the world, or when the world was a particular way, we felt safe in the world or not feeling safe now, those types of things, that changes our sense of self or how we see ourselves in the world. Mm-hmm. And so that's always a major transition for a lot of people.
All right, thank you. And Dina, your thoughts here.
So I agree with both of them. They are exactly right, Arn. But I also think we have small losses in our lives that we don't recognize. It's the mom who sends her kids off to kindergarten. Mm. When they graduate from high school, I married a military man. When you moved away from one place, and yeah, you still had that friends, but you lost all of that. So you have these little losses along the way, and what you do and how you cope with those, it determines how you're going to deal with the big losses in your life. And people don't necessarily recognize those little losses, and they're like, gosh, I'm just kind of feeling a little off. But, you know, when they look at the big picture.
And Dina, staying with you, the work that you do at Providence Hospital, you had a traumatic experience as a young nurse that you had not been trained for. Talk about that and how that led to the bereavement council and the other work that you're doing.
Absolutely. So I'm a labor and delivery nurse. That's what I do. And yes, we deal with a lot of grief and loss there. And as a brand new, I was a senior nursing student, and the county hospital where I lived hired people, the nursing students, to work on the floor. And we could do everything but medications. We could not go to the ER, ICU, the OR, and labor and delivery, because those are high-risk units. And one day, the house supervisor was frantic, and I was working on mom baby, and I said, can I help? And she said, yes, come with me. Threw me into some scrubs, and mind you, I was 21 at that time. So I was very young, and they put me in the delivery room because that's how we delivered back then. And this mom was hemorrhaging, and she was dying, and she delivered a dead baby. And they took me from, they went and showed me the baby, they wrapped the baby up, they took pictures. Mom lived, and I was like, oh my God, this is horrible. First of all, I didn't like OB in school. And they never talked about loss, death, much less a baby.
That is kind of stunning to know that was not part of your training.
No, not at all.
Of course, that's part of what happens at times. Not every baby survives.
It has for centuries, since the beginning of time. But that nurse took me from there to a live delivery, and I was sold. I already had jobs offered to me from ICU and ER because I'm an adrenaline junkie. But this was like, oh, people live here. I like this. I like that I can make a difference and see a change. So that was my very first experience. Mm. And when I got hired, I was like, yeah, I don't ever want to take care of that again. And I learned that nobody knew what to do and how to do it. And this kept happening. We kept having losses because that's what happens. And so I found myself to go seek out that education. In 1985, RTS is a group from Wisconsin and a hospital that started doing perinatal education. And now it's in the curriculum for the universities for nursing school. The medical students get death education, not as much as we'd like, but at least they have something.
And hospitals are focused, of course, on helping people get better after illness or injury. So how well trained are staff members at healthcare facilities generally when it comes to helping families with grief and for staff members also who experience these losses?
You know, some places are very, very good. Our chaplains are amazing. Some of the staff is amazing. Some people, you know, they have their own losses and they're like, I'm not doing that. And I'm just going to get through the day. And they don't have the skill set to do that. We're very fortunate that at Providence for the OB Maternity Center, I teach an 8-hour class to our new nurses that are coming on, our new graduates. And 8 hours of bereavement and grief and processing feelings, what they're going to see, just to prepare them so that they're not in that same situation.
If you're just joining us, this is Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Lori Townsend, filling in as host today, and we're discussing resources and ideas for how to deal with grief in our lives. Our guests today are Dina Banyas. Dina is an RN at Providence in labor and delivery. We also have Rabbi Abram Goodstein in the studio with us. Rabbi Goodstein is the rabbi for Congregation Beth Shalom in Anchorage. And Sevilla Love is on the line. Sevilla is a clinical social worker and psychotherapist in Alaska that engages in a lot of telehealth with Alaskans. For all of you, would you agree that there is an expectation that after a period of grieving, we too often hear, you'll get back to being happy again soon, that we're supposed to go back to someplace? when we lose someone we love, there's never any getting back to some kind of normal. We have to accept that our lives are forever changed, but we can still go forward and find happiness in the future. And that's a way to honor the person who is gone. Is this something you would suggest to someone who is struggling with loss, not to think that somehow they're going to return to anything?
Well, I mean, hopefully my panelists will agree, we often refer to, you know, when you lose a loved one, you have to embrace a new normal. Mm-hmm. And embracing a new normal is not just for loss of a loved one, right? Lots of reasons why you have to embrace a new normal. But that is a process. Mm-hmm. And in Judaism and many faith religions, we offer ritual as a tool to help with that process. Mm-hmm. Not everyone, it doesn't work for everyone. I happen to believe that most people grieve differently. Ritual is a helpful tool in order to help folks process their own grief.
And do you think part of that ritual is the fact that it is a controllable, kind of a comforting routine sort of a thing, that you understand what that process is, you know how to engage in it when everything else feels so out of control and chaotic?
I would say that's definitely a big part of it. In Judaism, we draw on, you know, thousands of years of tradition in terms of ritual. I believe that ritual is based in a wisdom of understanding kind of the process that people go through when they experience the loss of a loved one. I've worked with lots of people, and I've even tailored rituals for folks who feel like the standard Jewish one isn't working for them. And I think it's a wonderful tool.
Hmm. Dina or Savilla?
I'd like to throw in on the comment that you made about getting back to, that's something that a lot of people struggle with. I heard you mention earlier, Lori, that you were a widow, years ago. I myself too. I've been a widow, and in addition to lots of numerous other losses, mm-hmm. by an early age, I've lost every relationship type there is, except for my child, and by the age of 42, strangely enough. I'm older than that, though. But this concept that you brought up of getting back to, you know, you need to get back to the way you used to be so, and this is what a lot of my clients will tell me, you used to be so, you know, rambunctious. You used to be so energetic. You used to be so interested in things. You used to be really avid at this particular hobby. And the thing is, sometimes when they have a major life-altering loss, okay, there's lots of little losses, lots of things, small things that we grieve in the world. And I won't say small in terms of that they're not important, but things that change our entire sense of self and leave us wondering who we are and why we're here. That type of loss. There's really no going back. As you mentioned, it is really moving into the present moment with life as it is right now versus how it was, which incorporates how you have changed because of the loss. Mm. And since the loss, and one thing I think people struggle with is that they may have good things that actually arise in their lives after a loss. And people will say, I feel so bad that so-and-so had to die in order for me to understand this, be this, do this, have this. Mm. And what I like to address with that is the language that we use around it. It's not because they died, but since they died.
Mm.
Right? And it's a very different way of holding that energy. Mm-hmm. Because when we hold the because, it almost sounds like you're holding a lot of responsibility there that doesn't belong to us. And the since they died takes a different perspective of this is just as it is. This is what happened. And this is what has arisen as a result of the changes that have happened in life. So the person doesn't go back to, for example, and I'm sure a lot of people can relate with this. I had very avid hobbies that I did before my husband died 13 years ago. And after he died, I didn't touch any of them for years and years and years. And not because I was refusing, not because I was angry, but I had just lost the desire to go near that hobby anymore. And sometimes that's a result of trauma. Sometimes it's just I'm a different person now and my energy needs to go someplace else. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it is a sense of aversion for some people. It depends on what it is. But what I would say to people is don't allow that to alarm you, because you have changed. You have changed in feeling like you have to go back to who you were. Actually, in most cases, is not really possible, because who you were existed in the context of the person, whether it's a child or a spouse or something extremely close to you, which you so much identified your sense of self, it existed in the context of the other person being here on the planet with you. And mm-hmm. since they're gone, you have to transform now. And that takes time to do. So you're right, Lori, there's no going back. There is moving into the present moment now as it is and making those adjustments.
Dina, anything you would add before we go to the phones?
I will. I agree with both of them. You do find a new normal. Our society in the United States, we do not accept death very well.
Right.
And just even going back to work, how long is your bereavement leave? Well, 3 days. Okay, you can come back and we expect you to be at your best just like you've been before.
Wow.
And that's really hard for people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I work with people at the bedside. And sometimes you can't just say, oh, yeah, you're going to have a new normal, you know, down the future. They can't see that. It might be, take a breath right now. All right, you took that breath. Good job. Now let's take another breath. And before you know it, it's 5 minutes. Mm. Look what you've done. You've did great. And we just keep moving to the next goal that we're going to set. Mm-hmm. So, you know, maybe it's get up and brush your teeth, because that could be very hard to do. And to help them see that this is okay, and be gentle and have grace to yourself.
All right. Thank you so much, all three of you. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Todd is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hey, guys. Helpful for people, I think, this show. I'm a retired internist doctor, and I had an experience, I mean, lots of them, but early in training and towards the end of the first year of medical school, we were assigned to do history and physicals on new hospital admissions. And so I was assigned a woman, an elderly woman, who was there for rheumatoid arthritis treatment, I guess. And I walked in, introduced, everything was swimmingly well, you know, turned back around, and she was having a seizure. And then she died of a big heart attack right in front of me. And I was... I was stunned, shall we? I didn't know how to react, all right? I got the rest of the day off, and I just kind of wandered around, walked in circles maybe, and, you know, tried to put it in sort of a clinical detach perspective, like, oh, boy, you know, da-da-da. And I thought I did pretty well dealing with it, and maybe it helped me focus on my medical training and stuff. But in retrospect, I think it might have taken a little humanity and compassion, you know, and replaced it with a little more detachment than would be ideal, right? Mm-hmm. And I wonder how those early, not necessarily personal, but losses in that sense, professional and otherwise, impact providers and individuals. And, you know, is it something people usually benefit from talking about right away, or how do you guys see this stuff?
That's such a great question, because professional folks that deal with a lot of trauma and grief, whether it's in the health field or law enforcement, many areas where you're dealing with a lot of that, reporters deal with trauma often, and bottling it up isn't good, but you do have to compartmentalize a little bit just to get through the days that come, because those things keep coming toward you. What's a healthy way to sort of separate yourself but not bottle it up?
Well, I would suggest, you know, talking to your coworkers. I'm a talker, and by the time I say it the 10th time, it's like, okay, I can say it without crying. And those memories, those experiences make up who we are in the future, how we deal with it. You know, I chose to go seek this education to help people, and that's who I am, is able to cope with it. I found mentors that I was working with, and that's who makes you who you are. Thank you.
Yes, and we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion on Line One, Your Health Connection, as we look at resources for helping us handle grief in our lives.
I'm Theo Greenlee, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUCB, where I work in on Alaska, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm Lori Townsend, filling in as host today. We are talking about resources for dealing with grief in our lives. In the studio with me is Dina Banez. Dina is a labor and delivery RN at Providence and also runs a bereavement council there at the hospital. Also in the studio is Rabbi Abram Goodstein, who is the rabbi for Congregation Beth Shalom at Anchorage. And on the line with us is Sevilla Love. Sevilla is a clinical social worker and psychotherapist in Alaska. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-888-353-5752. That's 1-888-353-5752. If you're in Anchorage, you can call 907-550-8433. 550-8433. You can also email us, line1@alaskapublic.org. So Todd is on the line, a medical professional who lost a patient early. We heard some thoughts from Dina before the break about how to deal with these things. And Rabbi, I think you had some thoughts as well.
Yeah. Hey, Todd, thanks for the question. So I was a chaplain at Providence, of all places. One thing I noticed while I was there is that a lot of healthcare professionals, they witness a lot of traumatic things. One way that they manage what they witness is through problem solving, right? Every patient is a problem to solve. But if you look at sort of like those loved ones who are sitting with their like sick loved one, they don't have that option, right? They can't problem solve their way out of the trauma that they're seeing. They have to sit with it and be with it, and that's hard. Like that's and I think maybe Todd, you experienced some of that when this lady died. You lost all control of that situation, and you couldn't problem solve your way out of it. That is a difficult position to be in. I think someone said that like that when you experience this, you do change. Was that you, Sevilla, that said that? Yeah, that you do change, and that change isn't bad, right? That like you change from these experiences, and I think you become more wise. I think that's the consolation prize to losing someone or witnessing someone's death. But that change is not bad, and I tell that to folks all the time.
All right, Sevilla, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would. One thing that really helps, I've worked in alongside medical professionals my whole career, and one thing that we used to do, and I also would like to mention Rural Alaska and how they deal with that. It was mentioned how a lot of providers of any kind of healthcare workers aren't necessarily prepared to deal with the level of grief or trauma that they're going to be facing. We don't always get that training. And the same thing with the mental health field. And when providers are out in rural Alaska and you're looking at EMS, all the first responders, when something happens in a small community in Alaska, it happens to everyone. So the people who are responding, the people who are treating at the clinics, probably most likely know that person as well that they're treating. And so they're not only just treating a patient, they're treating their friend, they're treating their community member. And so it affects them on an additional level. And so one of the things we did out in rural Alaska is we had a critical incident debriefing team that would come together after every traumatic event for the providers, for the EMS. And so the police would be there, the fire people, everybody, the medical, the whole, anybody that was involved would be there and to help do the debrief because of this specific thing. Now, I think people in the cities probably don't get that. But one thing grief needs, and one thing that trauma, that we, to keep something from turning into trauma, is that it needs to be, the process needs to be interrupted so that it's seen, for example, that it's shared. So when we say we need to talk to colleagues, we need to have we need to be in groups. When something big goes down, a lot of times medical providers will get together and they'll say, okay, how did this go? How did the incident go? What did we do wrong? Can we do something better the next time? Those types of things. So those are also opportunities to be able to connect, because maybe then people are having conversations and it's like, oh God, that was such a hard one. Like, I don't even know if I'm going to sleep tonight. Mm-hmm. And so just having that opportunity to talk and share can help interrupt the process where people either get stuck in trauma or are able to move through this scary event that just happened. Just because it was bad and we would label it as traumatic doesn't mean it turns into trauma long term, as long as we're processing it as we go along. It's when it gets bottled and everyone says you should just handle it and stuff it down, that's when it turns in on us and ends up affecting the body, the life, our ability to function, leads to burnout, those types of things. Mm-hmm. So working together, talking together, being together is very important. And also organizations can bring in behavioral health people to do some kind of a critical incident. We had two people die at one of my places of employment, and we hired someone to come in and just do a big group meeting about it and to help us process it as an organization. So meeting it head on is important.
Mm-hmm. And for all of you again, and Dina, maybe we'll start with you. There's an old concept about the five stages of grief that was, it's a very, very old concept. It was first understood as stages that people who were dying were going through, and then it was applied to people who were grieving a loss. What do you think of this list of stages? A 2023 article in Psychology Today found it harmful rather than helpful. And when I think back to my own experience of especially my son, he had turned 7 the day before his dad died in a car accident. And so he was at that age where everything I read at that time said, children, especially boys, don't even see their fathers as humans. They're like superhero figures. So they can't connect to it in a way that is much more difficult for them to process. And I saw him bounce back and forth between anger and denial and depression. And he struggled with that for a very long time. And so it does seem strange to think there's just this list that you're going to check off and then, whew, okay, done with that.
Yes, thank you. That's a great question. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is the one who studied and gave us the 12 stages. And then they applied it to grief. And, you know, she did us a great thing, but yet a big disservice. Because when you say, here are the stages, people are like, okay, well, I'm in grief and denial right here, shock and denial. Well, then I'm going to go to this, then I'm going to go to this, and I should be done by 6 months because that's what it says. That's how long it says. And that's not how grief works at all. And just like you said for your son, it bounced back and forth. You know, shock and denial, you're not going to go back to. But that anger, that resentment, that, you know, would have, could have, should have, that you just bounce back and forth. And it's a lifetime. Yeah. You know, we talk about a new normal. Eventually, we hope and pray that you get to a point where you can compartmentalize that grief, put it up on the shelf. It's the anniversary. Take that box down, wallow in it for the day, but then you can put it back up there. But you still bounce back and forth. There's still moments of sadness, moments of happiness. So it's you go back and forth.
It's a lifelong journey.
It is. It
absolutely
is.
Absolutely. Rabbi, did you want to pick it up there? Or I also have a question I was going to aim at you next.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I believe that everyone sort of grieves in their own way. And I try to meet people where they're at any given time. So I don't look at the steps of
as
grieving
a list
or a guideline. I just don't think people fit in that list so easily.
Yeah, I agree. And you...
Can I say something about
that? Yes, please, Sevilla, go ahead.
I just want to say, I actually like the stages of grief. I'm going to tell you why.
Interesting.
People need to be able to understand their process because emotions don't make sense. And when we have something that we can hold on to for a moment, that tends to help. However, I want to qualify this. Telling somebody that they're going to go through these stages and then they'll be done, that is an absolute disservice. And Dina, I completely agree with that. However, knowing that this is what grief can look like at any given moment, and that we can hop around at all these different stages all at the same time, one after the other, but it's not linear. I think that's really important to be able to present when we're talking about stages of grief, that this is not a linear process. This is a human reaction to feel angry. It's a human reaction to feel like we're bargaining. It's a human reaction to feel some days that you're in acceptance of it, and then other days you're angry as heck and just can't accept it at all. So in that way, I think it can be useful, but it's important to put it within the right context. And then to add David Kessler, who's a very famous grief and loss expert had written a book along with, in conjunction with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. It's called The Sixth Stage of Grief. And the sixth stage they named as finding meaning. And he also wrote a book called Finding Meaning, which is actually very good. Some of my clients have really liked it. And finding meaning, which is once we have processed the biggest part of the trauma of the loss and we're ready to invite new things into our life, finding meaning actually can help bring a lot of additional healing into our lives.
All right. Thank you for that. And Rabbi, in your faith, you have traditions that require someone is buried within 3 days.
Oh, yeah.
You also have traditions that have someone sit with the deceased person until they are buried.
It's called Shmira.
Washing the body.
Shavar Kedusha.
Tell us about these traditions and why the body is not left alone during that time.
Oh, that's a funny one. It's really, I love what Savila said. It's actually really meaningful for our community to do that, to offer that, right? Because when we're a support system, and I often, I'm sure everyone else on my fellow panelists talk about support systems too, you know, and our community supports the loved ones of those who died. And so one of the ways we support them is by telling them, we are going to make sure that your loved one's body is going to be watched the whole time until it enters the ground. And people get a lot of meaning and a lot of relief from that, from knowing that their community is helping them through this process. That's part of it. The other more practical reason was because, oh, sorry, you have a question.
I love that, because what better way to say, I'm going to be with your loved one. They're not going to be alone.
Yeah,
I'll be there with them, so you don't have to worry.
Mm. Yeah, and then just sort of a reference to how old our religion is. You know, being a body, Judaism exists before modern refrigeration, and so you needed to make sure that nothing touched the body, including, I don't know, rodents, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so that we the tradition really is also practical as much as it is meaningful as well, which you're going to discover Judaism is a lot like that. It has like one side meaning and one side practical. Mm-hmm. The Chevra Kedisha, which sort of translates to burial society, those are a group of anonymous folks who ritualistically wash the body and then they dress it in a kittel, kind of a white sort of outfit. And they put it in a casket with that's a plain box with no nails. And this is part of our tradition that there is a democracy in death, that no matter what you achieved when you were alive, everyone is the same after they die.
All the caskets are always the same?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah. And the caskets are plain and designed to break down, or not designed, but they will break down sooner than, say, like a metal casket.
So they're not going in a vault in the ground.
Yeah.
They're just going into the ground.
Ideally, they're not going to a vault, though to protect the hill, a lot of times they are going to somewhat of a vault for the cemetery reasons. But yeah, and so these are the rituals that we offer. And many of the people who I work with, they find so much meaning in knowing that their loved one is going to be taken care of. I find so much meaning knowing that when I pass away, my body will be taken care of. I know this because of my community. So it's part of our process.
And similar to that, other cultures and other places also engage more directly with deceased family members, holding viewings in their home, washing and dressing the deceased person. In America, we have a funeral industry that deals with so much of this for most folks. After a death, the body is kind of whisked away and the family may or may not see it again. I attended the funeral of a dear friend in Kotzebue, and the reality of death was so stark. There were no manicured there wasn't a manicured cemetery or chiseled grave markers. There was no coverings over dirt piles, just a windy hill behind the community with many wooden crosses. Men of the family held the cross upright in the grave after the casket was lowered and held it while the dirt was filled in. There was nothing to cover over or sanitize what was happening. Do you think sometimes we're not dealing with grief in as head-on a manner as we should by sort of removing ourselves from that physical reality of what's really happening here?
We 100% protect ourselves from death. And there's a huge denial of death, which is very prevalent in the Western culture. In other countries, as we know, they do. The whole community comes out. David Kessler tells a story about, you know, the author David Kessler tells a story about, I believe it was New Zealand, how when somebody in the community dies, that everyone will go out and they'll change something in their, the community members will change something in their own homes or in their yard. They'll move the lawn chairs around. They'll do something different that lets the person who's had the loss know that we see you, you're not alone, and we know the world has forever changed. Mm. Not just for you, but for us too, and you're not alone. And in rural Alaska, you know, the whole community has come out. Like you said, it's, this is what, you know, we did. We would, somebody died that wasn't of suspicious nature, we would clean the bodies at the clinic. As a social worker, I helped with that. That's very unusual for a social worker to help with that. That's what we did. We all took part in it. And the community members would dig the grave and carry the casket and, you know, hold the body in. If it was cold out, they'd hold the body in the church until it was prepared for burial. Sometimes at the clinic, and it was just a community effort, and we don't get that in cities. And so being so separate from death, I think really we miss an opportunity to process, because when we experience a loss or some kind of trauma, we have our right and left brain is just not computing. They're not connected. They're not talking to each other. And so what the rabbi is sharing is this is how we help to process grief. This is how we help people to not feel alone. This is how we help them to understand the process of what's happened. And when we remove that, we're removing a piece of the human experience, because as a spiritual teacher named Ram Dass said, we're all walking each other home. And so if we can come together more often, you know, and when people say, well, I'm not going to go to the funeral, I don't want to, when they push themselves away from all of those opportunities, one, they're missing the piece that other community members, other family, other friends would bring back to them of the friend who died or the family member who died. We did this together. Or I remember this story. They get little pieces of the person that helps them to process the loss. And so when they remove themselves from that, which people do, they're also missing out on opportunity for the right and left side of the brain, the emotional and the logical side. Logical side says, yes, I know they're gone. The emotional side does not know that yet. Mm-hmm. In order for that integration to happen in the brain, like literally, having the process, having the ritual, having some kind of way to connect with other people around the death helps the brain to actually heal, so we can integrate the loss more effectively in our lives. Integrate meaning that we are able to more effectively grow around the loss, because the loss will stay the same size. You can 15 years out be on your hands and knees crying about a loss that happened 15, 20 years ago, but you may not be doing it every day, all day long. You might do it, like, you know, you said the grief box comes out and it opens up at Christmas and you cry for a while, those types of things. So getting that witnessing, having the ritual is so important for the brain to heal, for the body to heal, for the spirit to heal, for the emotions to heal, so we can integrate and be more effective and functional in our lives more rapidly.
Thank you for that. We are going to take another quick break. I was reminded of a movie I saw many, many years ago of a grandfather, an elderly man dying in the home. He was in his bed. His wife, grandmother, was sitting next to him, and a small child came in and tucked into his grandmother's lap, and she said, there's nothing to be afraid of here. Everything is fine. He's just dying. And she was very matter of fact about it and helped the child realize that he didn't have to be afraid in that moment. It was really a beautiful thing to see. We'll be back in just a moment as line one continues.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. We are talking about resources for dealing with grief in our lives. In the studio with me is Dina Banez. Dina is an RN at Providence in labor and delivery. We also have Rabbi Abram Goodstein with us in the studio. Rabbi Goodstein is the rabbi for Congregation Beth Shalom in Anchorage. And Savilla Love is on the line. Savilla is a clinical social worker and psychotherapist in Alaska. Dina, I wanted to ask you, well, let's go to the phones for a moment, and then we'll get to a question that I have about losing babies. Lindsay is in Wasilla. Hello, Lindsay.
Yes, hi.
Did you have a question or a story that you wanted to discuss?
I wanted to just add a nuance to the conversation. I'm actually familiar with Sevilla and her work, and I happened to be listening to the radio, and I experienced something that I felt as a loss, but it took me a long time to really put words to it, and that was an estrangement from my living adult child. And this is something I think that's happening more and more in families. Also, just dynamics within families that change can create this feeling of grief and loss, but it's not as acceptable as a death because people are still alive, they still exist, but a lot of the feelings are the same. And I did some research around that and found that the terminology for that is called ambiguous loss. And they use a lot of what you've talked about, adapted to accommodate the differences between someone who's died and someone who's living, but you're still experiencing very similar stages of grief, loss of identity and attachment. And so I wanted to suggest Pauline Boss and her work, which I found really helpful around ambiguous loss. One of the main differences being that you feel grief, but you're not allowed to have closure because the person's still alive.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people don't really know how to talk to you. They don't show up with casseroles at your doorstep because sometimes there's shame, embarrassment. People don't want to talk about it because especially if it's estrangement, they think, well, you must have done something to have warranted that. You know, there's just a lot more confusion around that kind of loss, but the person experiencing it still feels grief, but now they have the barrier of not really being able to talk about it even as much as you could talk about death.
Lindsay, thank you so much for bringing that clarity about something that so many people experience in their lives and how difficult that type of grief is. Especially for others around you to try to figure out how do I help or what can I do? This is not a type of grief that I understand. Thank you so much for that call. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for talking about it. And I will say within my research, getting out in nature is really helpful. People have created grief gardens, but just basically going to places that feel peaceful and restorative, finding new identity, kind of re-looking at your attachment to people, especially if it's family members, finding meaning, all the things that have been suggested are really helpful for people also experiencing this ambiguous loss, being able to talk about it, normalizing it. Those are all really helpful things I've found. So I just wanted to add that little extra for people who felt like they're feeling grief, but they're not allowed to feel grief because nobody died.
Absolutely. That is such an important distinction, too, is letting people know, of course, you can feel what you feel, and it's okay, and it's not wrong. And your idea about getting out into nature, that is my best therapy. It's always whatever's weighing on me, making me sad or anxious, it's take it to the woods and let it go in the trees.
And there's like countless memorial benches and trails here in Alaska, I think, vibing off of that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the wilderness, we're not so far removed from our wild ancestors. And we should remember that because the forest and the wilderness is a very healing place. It doesn't have to be scary for people that aren't familiar with it. It can be very comforting. I love to be out in the woods at night in the dark. I there's just something really special and unique about being in the forest at nighttime. Let's go back to the phones.
You also don't.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. You also don't have to be in the woods or the forest. You just gardening, getting
yes.
your hands in the dirt.
Oh, yes.
They've done research around that. And people that get their hands in the dirt actually is a chemical reaction, which I can't speak to scientifically, but there is a chemical reaction that's going on between the human and the dirt that actually helps to alleviate or reduce depressive symptoms. Mm. And it's been clinically studied. So it's very interesting.
Well, and it makes sense. It's physical activity. It's mm-hmm. exercise to some degree. And we know that exercise, I just saw a headline the other day that said there's a new study out saying that exercise is as effective as medication for certain types of depression, which makes total sense mm-hmm. to me. If mm-hmm. I'm really bugged out at the end of the day, boy, getting home, changing my clothes and hitting the trails is my best therapy that I find. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Jackie is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say a couple of things, a couple of quotes that I came across regarding grief. One in particular said, grief is hungry and opportunistic. And I think the opportunistic is especially on point. It's like just when you let your guard down, boom, there it is. And the triggers, like my mom died just over 3 years ago. Mm. And there are certain places where I go and I see things and the trigger is like, oh, gee, my mom would, oh, yeah, never mind, you know? And the other, and this was something I experienced after she died, which was what I called the year of firsts. And it doesn't really change after the first year. It just gets different. But the first birthday, the first Christmas, Thanksgiving, things like that, or for me, I would send my mother fancy cards for like every occasion. And those, like Easter, Mother's Day, just because. And seeing those cards is like this little dagger. And that's when it's opportunistic and your guard is down. But it's the year of first that I think gets a lot of people. Christmas kind of sucks because my mom died in December. Mm. So, and our subconscious, even though we might forget after a few years, our subconscious never forgets.
That's right. Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you, Jackie, for the call. We had an email. It's sort of long, so I can't read all of it, but this is from Rich and Karen Parker in Juneau. They lost their son to leukemia after 7 years of hospitalizations just before his 26th birthday. This was in the 80s. And they had developed strong relationships with the staff and the caregivers. They were in Vermont at that time. And then Rich writes, they tried hard to accommodate our requests for all sorts of care options, but ultimately nothing was effective, even when it became clear that he wouldn't recover. He said, afterward, we had the privilege of being invited to attend the Schwartz Round and address the doctors and nurses. Their message was, we appreciate all the care that we and our son received. We'd like to give you this bit of insight. You are highly successful professionals, probably at the top of your classes, and yet nothing in your training ever really prepared you for failure. In retrospect, perhaps it would have been better to work with us and our son to prepare us for the inevitable, much as hospice does now, but usually for older folks. Our hope is that you can be helped, trained to understand this important aspect of care, putting aside your own professional desires to always succeed. Such an important message about, yes, helping people deal with all of us. You know, the odds are against us all. 3 out of 3 don't get out alive. And so we're all heading in that direction, and understanding what that will mean and how that will affect our lives is so important. I wanted to get to a question, Dina, about losing a pregnancy or delivering a baby that didn't survive, that is really tough. I had a dear friend who tried for years to get pregnant, went full term, finally at the last possible point in her, you know, her biological age that she could have a child, went full term, the baby died. Mm. And they knew the baby had died before she delivered it. She had to deliver a dead baby. Mm. And when you counsel people in this setting, how does it differ, or does it, from helping people grieve that had a relationship with a loved one and have memories for at least some solace? And you don't have that. None of that exists in a lost pregnancy. How do you help people then?
So when they do have their baby, we encourage them to name the baby, to hold the baby. We have outfits and blankets that we can wrap the baby up so they can hold their baby. We encourage them to bathe the baby. And as they're doing all those things, they're creating memories. We take pictures in the hospital, candid pictures, posed pictures. There's a professional volunteer group that can come into the hospital and take professional pictures that you could hang on your wall. They're beautiful. But we try to create memories for these families. And one thing I do tell my moms is, you know this baby. this baby was safe with you. You loved this baby. This baby felt your love. And that helps them, some of them. Yeah. You know, the difference between a child that was born alive and they have all those memories and a baby, the loss is still the same. It's the same hurt. A mom, like your friend, who had tried and tried and tried, this was very significant. That is their child. From the time she got pregnant that she knew, that was a baby.
Yeah.
For some folks, it's just tissue. Mm. It's a pregnancy, and they lose it, and they don't have any thoughts. So you have to figure out where they are and what they want to do. And we don't talk about pregnancy losses, so you need to normalize it and say this happens to a lot of people, but you don't know that your coworker lost a baby because that's not something they come up and say, hey, we did this.
All right.
The rituals that the rabbi was talking about plays a very important part in pregnancy loss when they do that. Mm-hmm. From Providence Hospital, every year we have an annual walk called the Walk to Remember. And we invite families from Providence who have had the loss to come. And some people have come for 17 years because this is the only place that they're safe, that they can hear their baby's name out loud. They can write a passage or whatever they want to say that will be heard out loud. And they're with other people who've had the same loss. And they don't have to say anything. They can say something if they want to. And to know that you're not alone, no matter what kind of loss you've had, a pregnancy, an ectopic, a stillborn, a neonatal loss shortly after delivery, a 5-year-old child, an 89-year-old grandmother, it still hurts all the same. You know, some people think, oh, if it was 4 weeks old. How did you know if it, in pregnancy? How could you be grieving this much? But they had an attachment to this child, and that's all that matters.
They had thoughts about the future.
Exactly.
And what that would hold.
All the future things are gone. The wedding, the graduations.
Yeah. We only have a few minutes left here, and I wanted to ask about helping people when it feels so overwhelming at times. I know that for myself, when my husband died, my children were very small, and some days were so overwhelming, and I would think, okay, I'm only going to take this little piece today because I know none of it's going away. It's still going to be there. So I don't have to worry about remembering it all because it'll be there. But I can only deal with this. So I'm going to focus on this today and get through this. And then tomorrow I'll look at another piece of it.
Excellent.
Do you talk to folks about just taking small pieces? As you said, Dina, the box on the shelf. Okay, yeah. I got to take it and open it up and get something else out of there today.
Yep. Give yourself grace, and I like what you said, I can only do this part today, and that's exactly what you do, is you just do that part. And even if your goal was to do that part, and it was too overwhelming, and you couldn't do it, it's like, okay, I can do it tomorrow.
Yeah.
And maybe this is where you ask friends to come in and help. They can do the dishes, they can do the laundry, they can get the kids to school or pick them up, because you're just having a bad time at that moment. It's not forever, and there's a point where if you can't get up and brush your teeth and take care of your family and yourself, then we need to be looking at counseling. We need to be looking at help and to do that.
But you can trust yourself. I always trusted myself to know I can get fallow for the day. I can know that I just can't do it today.
That's right.
But I trusted myself to know I'll come out of it tomorrow. I'll be okay tomorrow.
And a lot of people do that, but there are some people who can't.
Yes.
And that there's help out there for them. And they're not alone. A lot of people do this. And people put the shame on it of seeing a counselor or getting help. Absolutely not. Life's too short.
We all need help. We all need support.
Exactly.
Yeah. All of us.
You can feel good or decent, or you can feel very bad. So you make your choices along the way. And some people do that as punishment to themselves, too. Mm.
Rabbi, in just a minute here so we can try to get Sevilla in one more time, too, in our final moment, your thoughts here. I know for myself, I always had to lean into work. When I was grieving work, mm-hmm. I would be, you know, just like I had to have a physical project, sanding the floors or something like that. That's what I did when my mother was dying. And it helped propel me through something that I couldn't control. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts?
I mean, I often find myself giving people permission. right? Permission to feel, permission to only tackle whatever they can handle. Like, I feel like people sometimes need just to need that someone to say, yeah, I'm hearing what you're saying, and that sounds right to me. You know, I'm not want to say that, or help name kind of what they're feeling. I'm often wrong, and they help me find it. Like, I'll say, oh, you sound angry. Like, well, I'm not angry. I'm frustrated. I'm like, oh, well, you sound frustrated. I'm like, yeah. How'd you know that? I was like, well, you just told me that. You know, just trying to figure out where they're at, trying to figure out their thing, and trying to name those feelings and often permission. Mm-hmm. Is often where I find myself. But also, I think we were talking about this earlier, just being there, like, yes. Presence. Like, that's not, you don't have to say anything at all sometimes.
You don't have to say anything. You just sit in silence.
Just sit with silence with them.
Sevilla, quickly, just about 30 seconds here.
I just want to throw out a book, The Grieving Brain, The Surprising Science of How We Learn from Love and Loss, talks about how we dose grief. And so if you think about how we will take a medicine, we need to titrate up or down to incorporate all the beneficial parts of the medicine. We need to do that also with yes. grief. A little bit at a time is okay.
That's right.
You can't handle it all at once.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much to my guest, Dina Benaz, Rabbi Abram Goodstein, and Sevilla Love. Thanks to our engineer, Crystal Hyde. Our producer is Madeline Rose. And our editor is Annie Feit.
And I thank everybody who shared?
Yes.
That's a big step. Thank you for sharing.
Yes. Thanks, everyone, for your calls. And Line One will be back next week. I'm Lori Townsend filling in.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.